Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 126 of Real Blend, a podcast that fights for family and lives for love.
Why did you think we wouldn't understand that joke? Well, you just told us before we started recording that we wouldn't understand it.
Maybe you didn't watch the video. I didn't know if maybe you didn't watch it. I knew you watched the video.
I sent you the video!
But Kevin might not have watched the video. You gotta pay attention to the Twitter feed, essentially, where we tried to get something trending last night.
That did not take off at all.
Didn't go very well. This was a commercial for ABC Family, where they were doing Batman Begins, and where we learned that Bruce Wayne fights for family and lives for love. It was very heavily featuring Katie Holmes and her character.
I still like the other one that was set to the very Batman appropriate band of Nickelback.
Yes,
there was a TV spot that must have aired the summer of 2005.
Yeah,
because apparently Nickelback was like the band of early 2000 superhero movies.
Sure.
Because they had Spider-Man. I'm gonna throw a hot take out there. I don't think Nickelback is bad.
Yes, yeah, they
really
are.
They're really bad.
I don't think... here's the deal. I'm not saying that I like Nickelback or that I'm a fan or that I'm listening to them casually, but I think that Nickelback now falls under this umbrella of people, or of a band that people think it's cool to say they don't like.
That's fair. That's fair.
I agree with Jake on that, only because growing up, that was Dave Matthews for me. Mm-hmm. I was always it's funny, as I get older... I'm 36 now. I'm starting to understand that I can be wrong. I can have a wrong opinion. Do you know what I mean, though? I guess there's a stubbornness to when you're growing up and you like a band so much, you like something so much, and you stay forward on that path because you don't want to go against yourself.
Sure.
And I always found Dave Matthews. I didn't like Dave Matthews, but I always found myself hating on Dave Matthews only because that's just the way my mind was thinking about Dave Matthews. Right. But now, as I get older, I'm like, okay, John Smith might love Dave Matthews. That doesn't mean Dave Matthews is a bad band. I just don't prefer his music. And so Nickelback fell into that category for me where there's a monumental element of hate surrounding Nickelback. It's a joke now that they're considered one of the worst bands of all time.
Yeah.
To Jake's point, though, they're super talented artists. They can write music.
And also, statistically speaking, they are incredibly successful.
Oh,
They are multi platinum. Gabe is like, what the hell is going on?
How did we get down this rabbit hole?
We got to the opening joke,
and this
show just went off the
rails.
Jake, did you hear about they got the name of the band because they went to a 7-Eleven and got a Slurpee for 95 cents, gave them a dollar, and they gave them a nickel back?
That almost sounds like it could be accurate.
It sounds like a solo
I kind of believe that. Anyway, my name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at CinemaBlend. The
other two guys are
Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago and Kevin McCarthy in Fox 5, Washington, D.C. Let's get right to episode highlights because we are off the rails already. We're going to discuss whether Kill Bill 3 should be Quentin Tarantino's next movie. And final movie, potentially, we are going to discuss whether movies should return to theaters without U.S. markets. And we have an interview this week with author and screenwriter Rebecca Dinerstein-Knight, who wrote The Sunlit Night, which stars Jenny Slate. And she did the screenplay for her own novel. And we got some really great insight into adapting your own book and the changes that have to be made to those movies as they get here.
And I got told that I asked a mean question.
Did you by her?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember that. Did
remember
you do that?
I asked a question? She's like, oh, that's such a mean question.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh. She wouldn't answer
it. She's so sweet. She's like the nicest person.
Yeah,
so for her to say it just kind of crushed. Yeah. Like any other person tells me that, I don't care. But the fact that leading up to that, she was the nicest person maybe we've ever interviewed.
That is.
And then I asked a question. She's like, oh, that's so mean. And I was like, oh, God.
That's a great
tease. A little tease for you folks.
Well, that is coming up soon. All right. Plugs. We have a community page over on Facebook where everybody is sharing what's going on in the world of movie news. They are starting polls and even sponsoring viewing parties that Arthur has sort of taken the lead on, so thank you very much for that.
That's
Arthur,
so cool.
That's your second shout out now. Arthur also live tweets the show once in a while.
And which I love.
I do too.
And not just because he often agrees with my takes.
Like, always agrees with your takes and is like adamantly opposed to almost anything that I say. So, but I still love him. He's really sweet. He's a nice guy. One of our earliest blenders and one of the Chicago community as well. If you're watching us visually, that means you know that we are posting these episodes on Cinema Blend's YouTube page. And of course, we are available all of the different places where you can download podcasts. Last plug before we get to the show proper. We have a merchandise store. Oh, Gabe, this was really cool. So anyway, if you go to cinemablend.com/shop, you can get a mug like Kevin's drinking what? Out of right now. Well played, Kevin. Well played.
The timing on that.
T-shirts and tank tops and a tote bag and all this really cool
definitely
stuff.
Definitely an ad.
Yes, without a doubt.
Which is so funny because there are so many moments in the history of this show that you've said something and be like, just a heads up, this is like, we're not sponsored. This is, but for the yeah. first time in the history of the show, you actually threw an ad out there.
So I went to our.
I was kidding. But I did pay for that mug.
I went to our YouTube page to watch one of the clips most recently, and there's a bar underneath it now with link to our merchandise. What? Gabe, tell me how that happened.
What?
I'm just a marketing genius, I guess. I mean, I don't know.
Tell them what they want.
No, yeah. If you watch stuff on YouTube, you'll start seeing Real Blend merch to buy at your convenience. It's like with the little candy bars next to the checkout counter.
Yeah.
Impulse buy. Oh, you impulse buy God. A shirt.
Ooh, you know? Could you do like four little bobbleheads and like each of the bases kind of link together? So if you buy each of us individually, like they can turn into like you can link them together and then they have like four little bobbleheads.
I'll get right on that. Yeah,
that's actually a really cool idea. That's actually a really cool idea.
Yeah, we'd be blended together, right?
Exactly. What? Yes.
Yeah. What? For real? And then every time you listen to the show and one of us says something you agree with, you can just tap us on the head and we'll kind of nod at you.
Only because deep down, I really want to keep track of who sells more bobbleheads. Right? Like, I would love to.
We all know it'll be Gabe.
I would really.
Yes. Gabe, like, it'll be Gabe, and then the rest of us will be in a distant second, third, and fourth place.
All three of ours don't talk, and Gabe's should have a voice.
And never stop talking. You can't turn it off. It just yammers all day long. All right, weekly poll. Listen, now I'm kind of into that bobblehead idea. That's actually pretty intriguing.
Right? Isn't that actually really cool?
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Jake, tell me the answer to the weekly poll. It said, which new movie will you stream first? Last weekend, we were blessed with a string of new films, and it might be one of the most busy weekends that we're going to see in July, because July is looking a little bit thin, unfortunately. We had Tom Hanks in Greyhound going to Apple TV+. We had Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti in the Hulu comedy Palm Springs. Charlize Theron was in The Old Guard and the horror movie Relic, all four of those. So we asked everybody Theron? Which movie would they stream first. Do what now?
You say Theron?
Charlize Theron.
Theron.
No. It's Charlize Theron. Now, I'm not wrong with this one. Gabe? It is absolutely Charlize Theron.
Gabe? It is Theron.
I'm fairly confident if you Google how to pronounce Charlize Theron, it's a video of her pronouncing it for you.
It is not Charlize Theron.
I think it's Theron, dude.
No, in Sean's defense, I have pronounced it Charlize Theron my entire career.
Yes, because that's what it is.
Doesn't mean he's right. You said Mendes.
It's the same reason why Martin Scorsese is wrong. Same exact
people
thing.
Say that?
Yeah.
Scorsese.
No, it's Scorsese.
But people say Scorsese because... So like basically what ends up happening when someone gets famous, I think... is that the name gets so messed up and commonly that it just becomes their name. Yes. So, like, I mean, like, Martin Scorsese is wrong, but everyone calls him Martin Scorsese.
I hate you.
So either way, Sean, you're wrong.
I hate you guys.
No,
wait, Gabe, what is that? Is that an audio thing that you can play? Can you add it to the show? You're going to add it to the show. Add it to the show in post?
I don't hear Gabe.
I can't
turn your microphone
Gabe.
On, dude.
Yeah, I don't think there's a copyright on that. I can probably do
you
it.
You think so? All right.
It's a Google search, right? Can you copyright a Google search?
No, you can't at all. So if there's just audio a video she made for Google, then just play it in the show.
How to pronounce Charlize Theron. Well, that was it. Charlize Theron. Charlize Theron. Not Charlize Theron, but Charlize Theron.
It's one, right. You're wrong. It's one of the names that is basically acceptable. to say wrong. What other names are acceptable to say wrong? Scorsese, Theron, who else?
Schwarzenegger.
There's a couple others that are like
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
There's a couple others that are actually okay. Like people
Sylvester
just say
Stallion.
Right, Stallion.
That's all right. So the weekly poll. This episode's gonna be like 4 hours long.
Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks. Anyway, Jakey.
I don't care. Whatever.
What movie of all those? Palm Springs. Palm Springs dominated.
I was gonna say Palm Springs actually because I feel like we really talked it up on the show last week.
You said you didn't care, and not only did we talk it up on the show, but I saw a lot of people in the Real Blend community on the Facebook page and on our social media raving about the movie, that they checked it out, had a lot of fun with it. It was one of the most fun things that they saw this year. I think that's really cool. Now, what makes me sad about that is that that's the prime movie where if theaters were still open, it would be a breakout hit, right? Like word of mouth would power it. Maybe it wouldn't open to a huge number, but more people would go check it out. So I wish that that movie had a great sort of run through theaters because I just think it would perform really well with a crowd and it would have been a fun theatrical experience, but I'm glad it's on Hulu and people can check it out. So that was our weekly poll where I learned how to pronounce Charlize Theron and how to mispronounce Tom Hanks. So, all right, this week's interview. This is Rebecca Dinerstein Knight, who ended up being an incredibly sweet participant in the Real Blend community. She was a really great interview. She is promoting her film, The Sunlit Night, with Jenny Slate. So without further ado, the Real Blend interview with Rebecca Dinerstein Knight. So I was researching and listening back through a ton of fun interviews with you when the film was going through Sundance. And I loved the story that you told about Jenny Slate on Twitter and finding her that way. And so I'm just curious, for people who don't know, essentially they passed each other. She decided to use social media to her advantage and catch a celebrity's eye. And Jake is doing that a ton nowadays to try to get Zoom interviews. So I want to know how you use social media now. Are you still trying to use it to reach out to people? Is it successful? Like, was that the first way that you sort of knocked down a wall to reach out to your idols?
Wow. Cool question. I am using it less and less as I sort of feel like many people might be. I mean, or maybe it's going more and more. Who can say? I tweeted at Jenny in 2014 when Twitter felt like very young and fresh to me. Yeah. And I don't, I mean, who would know what would happen today? Jenny is so exuberant and so generous that maybe if it happened again right now, well, not right now, but in another time, she would still respond. But there was a certain innocence to a tweet 6 years ago just landing at its target and being received with a lot of warmth. If there's any celebrity out there who's going to still do that, it's Jenny Slate. But I'm really happy it happened when it happened, for sure.
What was your exact tweet, out of curiosity? Do you remember what you said?
Oh, yeah, for sure. What a day. At Jenny Slate blew me a kiss. End of tweet. And Jenny responded, sorry we didn't get a chance to chat. I was on the phone. Which was like exceptionally generous because I was an anonymous fan who had awkwardly applauded at her in the middle of a park. So,
are you now more open to people tweeting you and potentially like trying to start conversations? Because then you could say like, well, I was that person once and someone gave me a shot, so maybe I should give this person a shot too?
Totally. That's a really cool question. Yes, but I love it when people, I mean, I just had a new book come out, Hex, and people wrote to me on Instagram direct messenger, which was new, feels like a new way to communicate. And that was so beautiful. I got the most extraordinary essays on DM about the book and about how they read it. And I loved it. And I love responding to it. And I totally feel that tenderness for this can be a meaningful interaction. But, you know, people have got to play play nice to get nice in that.
All those DMs are not usually that positive.
What?
Yeah, look at our DMs.
Yeah.
They're never that nice.
Rebecca, I find it so interesting when an author adapts their own book. I mean, it's a very fascinating thing to think about, because film and books are two completely different mediums, that and narrative works different in each of them. You could do certain things in books that you can't do in films, and vice versa. So I was just interested for you, from a from when you write the screenplay from your book, what are some things that you had to let go that you kind of were upset you had to let go because they didn't work in a narrative structure of a film? But then, or did you adjust them somehow to work in a film? What are some examples of those?
Yeah, wow. I mean, so much on two levels, because first there's the compression of the book to the screenplay, and then there's the compression of what we shot to what's in the film.
Oh, wow.
And I will say actually that what's more actively heartbreaking to me, and not heartbreaking, but just what I miss more acutely, is stuff that we shot that is so gorgeous that didn't make it into the movie because it didn't fit structurally. I don't know if that's more immediate because I remember it so vividly. I mean, I wrote the book like over a decade ago and we shot it two summers ago and it was the coolest thing to shoot it. So everything we lost from that shot, I really miss. But at this point, I don't mind at all how different it is from the book. I'm so pumped about where it has landed and what it is now. And I think it's kind of an extraordinary expression of the book's essence, even though it's different and it's missing a ton of characters and most of what happened. No, that's not true. I was going to say most of what happens in the book doesn't happen in the movie. It's not quite most, but it's definitely a different piece of art. And I think they're both doing their right thing.
Was there one particular thing that was that was hard to transition to a film? Like, you write it in your book and you go, oh my gosh, I really want that in the film. But and then you had to adjust it somehow, or you just had to lose it.
Yeah, I mean, what was hard for us is that the book is really equally about Yasha and Francis. It goes back and forth between them absolutely equally. And we filmed it that way, but we wound up really needing to tell one story. Mm. And focusing on Francis's story really allowed us to make the film coherent in a way that a novel just has more room to tell stories simultaneously. So that was tough, but I really like where we landed with it.
Cool.
You know, I always love when, because I feel like it's a rare privilege for an author to be able to adapt the screenplay for the movie based on their book. And I know anyone who's ever sort of had that experience of reading a book and then seeing the movie, you sit there and you kind of do that very obnoxious thing. You're like, well, actually, that's not what happened. X, Y, and Z happened because I read the book. So I was just sort of curious if there were any cinematic adaptations out there that you wish that the author had been able, he or she had been able to actually write the screenplay, because then it maybe actually would have been better.
Wow. You know, I don't know how much Jonathan Safran Foer had to do with the Everything is Illuminated adaptation, but I know that they cut out like the wacky voice driven stuff out of that adaptation, which is totally the center of the book. And I don't think that was his doing, because that's very much the heart of what that book was doing. So that was an example where I feel like it lost its mojo and he would have kept it in. But
well, random reason. That's a good one though. That's a good one.
That's a really good one.
I'm stepping over Sean for a second because Jake's question just kind of brought something in my mind.
How dare you?
I'm sorry, Sean. I love you, buddy. I'll call you later and apologize. But in general, like, you do hear of certain authors that say that they'll never turn a book into a movie. I believe, was it Catcher in the Rye was one of them, I believe, that will never, and then the gentleman who wrote the Watchmen, he was, apparently did not want to be involved in those film adaptations. What are your thoughts on, just in general, like, Hollywood does really go after books, right? And they look for these amazing stories. Do you, as an author yourself, what do you find, do you find it interesting that some authors don't want that transition?
Yeah, interesting and a bummer. You know, it was the greatest pleasure of my life to be a part of this movie. And obviously, I think most young writers feel that way. I don't think that's a special way to feel. And I do think that if you're astronomically established and not willing to put in 16-hour days on set and not willing to compromise with a director who's going to unravel and rewind your work, I can see it. But for me, being able to totally hand over something to a new set of creative talents, like be a part of that set environment, work with it day in and day out, it was a total pleasure, and I'd recommend it.
Rebecca, we've had conversations with directors over the years who have talked about how important the opening scene of their film is, because in those moments, that's the most dedicated they have an audience member. You know, the film has just opened and it could be Citizen Kane or it might be, you know, Police Academy 5. And then they're not sure yet. They got to wait and see how it plays out. Yeah. You open with a scene that hurt me so much. It was so brutal. It was these three critics picking apart a portrait, essentially. And it's only after a minute or two that you pan over and realize that the artist is sitting there. So right. I was intrigued when I realized that you reviewed for a while. You reviewed restaurants and you reviewed books. And I didn't know if that came from any place of guilt at the criticism you had to level. Or did you ever have to like critique something in front of a person as they were sitting there? It was such a specific dig or joke that I was like, that has to come from someplace emotional.
Well, first of all, very dope work that you just did, because nobody has ever put that together, and well done. I don't know, that was great.
Interview prep, it goes a long way.
Rebecca, I gotta say this in a weird way, that we were texting today about the word dope, literally texting really? Today about how yeah. underrated that word is.
Oh,
you just said dope. Yeah. Is the weirdest coincidence ever. We just talked about that today.
Our producer Gabe uses it all the time. He's
it's
very
so crazy. Weird.
Go ahead. Completely clutch vocab there. this is a classic like English student example where you've made a connection that is so sharp and so cool and not at all something I was thinking of or aware of. Like, first of all, it's not the beginning of the novel. It's not okay. even close to the beginning of the novel. Second of all, it's not even the way that I think I remember wanting to start the movie. Third of all, it is related to experiences that I think every artist has had of crits, like in writing workshops, things get torn apart and it's miserable and you're sitting right there and you can't do anything about it. So I was able to write that from experience. Mm. But it wasn't a dig so much as just the truth of where Francis is. I mean, that's just what happens. Mm. And it's a very different sort of humiliation than the way the book opens, which is with like sexual humiliation. So I'm glad it's art humiliation instead, because it would have been a really different movie to start it the way the book starts.
Sure. I think a publicity moment for this movie should be like a critic reviewing your film and then we pan over to you listening to it. Like,
that'd be it's happened. You can find it if you want. It's available to you.
Well, the line where the guy says, he goes, it's actually making me angry. And then there's yeah. a long beat and the other guy says, I can see that.
Yo, Rebecca, one thing I love about the visuals in this film, it's a gorgeous film. You can see it in the trailers. Like it's a gorgeous, gorgeous film. Mm. What is the challenge to writing gorgeous, colorful moments like that? In the sense of like on your page, on your screenplay, like do you detail like how beautiful the landscape looks or like...
And I want to just add a little bit to that, because it's like part of the thing is the assignment that Jenny Slate's characters do is yeah. paint a barn yellow. And when it's described that way, I was like, yeah, it's like manual labor. But then when they start doing it, I was like, there's so many shades of yellow. It's so it's so beautiful. So yeah, thank you, Kevin, for asking that.
Yeah. How do you include like the colorful nature of your setting in your script?
That's such a nice question. Wow, I come from a poetry background, so I was living up in the Arctic writing a book of poems about how beautiful the Arctic is. So that is like very much my training, like writing about beauty and why it's beautiful and how it's beautiful and in a poetic way is totally the name of my game. The fact that somebody let me make a movie about how beautiful Norway is is like such a gift, because it's not violent and it's not even dramatic. It's just like, this place is beautiful, let's look at it. And this incredible team of producers are like, yeah, let's do, like, let's look at it, which is just what the movie is doing. But yeah, I've spent, I don't know, I guess 15 years writing about beauty. So that is my trade. And then we also had an incredible team. Our director really understood how to make things vibrant. We had a Norwegian guy named Urian painting that barn in real time. And he he asked me, what's going on here for you visually? And I said, Munch, the Norwegian painter, who is known for The Scream, but actually if you look at his landscape paintings, they're immense and colorful. And then this painter, Alf Salo, who was really up in the Arctic, who focused on yellow. And we looked at a bunch of his work and we looked at a bunch of Munch, and this guy just got to work. The barn is really there. It's an extraordinary place if you ever have a chance to go to the Arctic. But everybody just believed in the beauty of the landscape up there, and it worked.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know, when any person reads a book, obviously we envision it in our head. We sort of cast it in our head, and you know, all four of us could read the same book and it would look different in all four of our minds. So when they start casting the roles, is there any part of you that, I mean, obviously like everyone did a great job, but is there any part of you that sort of like looked at any of the casting and went like, huh, like that's not quite how I pictured
it. Well, that's such a mean question. I'm not going to answer it.
How to say who?
Name names.
No. Oh, shoot.
Or, okay, let me rephrase this so it's less mean. Yeah. Like, were there moments where you just sort of, where maybe the vision that was brought onto the film made you look at your own work differently?
Cool.
That's better.
Ooh, yeah. Repurpose out.
and to adding, I think what Jake's trying to say is, when you saw Jenny play the character or any actor play the character, how did it change the character you wrote in your book from? I think that's what Jake was trying to get at. It was like sure. Did it change the perspective of like the person you wrote? Did Jenny bring something new
teamwork.
To that person?
Teamwork. Boys, come I love on. It. We're getting there. We're getting there.
Great. Jenny made the character like brave and funny and hot and all kinds of things that the character in the book isn't. The character in the book is like confused and lonely and whatever. I mean, not to like condemn my own book, but the character in the book is young and confused. And Jenny is like smart and powerful. So that was a great transformation that I really embraced. What else? I mean, the parent characters are pretty right on. Nils, who is totally central to the book, was played perfectly, I feel, by Fridtjof Solheim. So not a lot of dissatisfaction. And the places where it did transform, as I've said, were sort of delightful, because I wrote the book when I was young and it's nice to see it take on a slightly more mature form. So no dirt, no gossip from me.
We're going to get you out of here on this last question. Hex, obviously, is out now. People can get Hex now. Is that right?
They sure can. Look, it's right here.
And are you going down this process for a Hex film adaptation? Or was this, are you really? Oh, is that already started?
Yeah, all day. I've been working on it.
Are you adapting your screenplay like you did last time? Cool.
Yeah, very, very.
Where are you at?
Is it easier too?
It's slightly easier because the novel is basically a screenplay. I was writing the novel while we were rewriting the Sunland Night screenplay for Zach Galifianakis. So the whole book is like dialogue to begin with. So that's definitely easier, but I'm looking at it for a television format, for a series format. So that's a little bit new. And it's really exciting. And, I'm still pretty early on in treatments and stuff, but I think it's going to roll right out.
That's awesome.
Rebecca, I know we're letting you go. I just want to tell you the line that I liked, and it's also in the trailer, the line about it's almost so beautiful, it looks like a bad painting. It's like, I feel like that reminded me of when you look at a TV and it's playing that motion smoothing thing. You're like, it looks so good, it looks bad.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? That's how that's
what it was. That line.
You do what?
we really had to like strike that balance up there because it's ridiculous. It's yeah. like a joke about itself.
It could look it could look CG or green screen. That's where you almost can go down that path. It could look there are things that look so good they look bad. It's so weird.
Yeah.
I love that line. It just helped me explain that in my mind more. So,
thank you so much for joining the Real Blend podcast.
You guys are a riot. Thank you for having
thank
me.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Thank you. And we're going to point everybody to go see Sunlit Night on July 17th through various portals. Obviously, we're still trying to figure out what's going on, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be on digital and some sort of release.
Digital, it's there for you, and I hope you love it. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Well, you will. You absolutely will. We've been able to see it, and I can tell you guys that it's a great film structured around the always brilliant Jenny Slate. So thank you, Rebecca, for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Obviously, we want to thank Rebecca for coming on Real Blend, and be sure to look out for The Sunlit Night when it reaches paid VOD on Friday. We're going to have a review of that later on in the show. Talking points.
The only thing I didn't get to ask her was when they slated on set, like, was there like an inside joke? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if they're slating the camera,
yeah,
it's got to be a little bit of a bit, right?
Slate on slate, where they do that kind of. You should have asked her that. That'd be a really good question.
What am I thinking? What am I doing with my life? How did I not get that answer? Damn it,
Gabe. Can you email her a follow up question? We'll run on next week's show. All right. Talking points. There's a trailer that dropped recently for an Amazon Prime film that's coming on July 24th. And if we had Oscars anymore, it might contend for a number of categories, especially for Rosamund Pike's, who looks fantastic. She's playing Marie Curie in a film called Radioactive. Trailer just dropped. You guys can check it out if you want to. I thought it looked really, really interesting. It's funny. We just had a conversation the other day about biopics and what makes some of them interesting versus other ones that are not. There's a hook in the middle of this one that really was a gut punch to me. I won't tell you guys what it is in case you want to watch the trailer or maybe even go into this story blind. And I kind of think at this point, all three of us are on board with anything that Rosamund Pike does. So I assume this is something you guys feel like checking out. You'll see when it comes to Amazon Prime.
Yeah, for me, it kind of falls under that biopic umbrella where I think the performance looks better than the actual movie does, which tends to be, for me, kind of my issue with films like that. I think she looks absolutely incredible, and it does not surprise me in the least bit. The movie itself, I think, looks fine. I knew a little bit about that story kind of going in, so I knew the direction it was heading. And if you don't know much about the story, I would argue just wait until you see the film because it's going to take some really interesting directions that you might not expect. But I think, like I said, I think the movie looks fine, but I think she looks fantastic. So obviously, yeah, definitely worthy of my time.
Yeah. And I was telling you guys prior to the segment that when I watched the trailer, I couldn't help but think about the slates they were putting up that literally looked like Shape of Water. Like the trailer, like you ever notice that sometimes where like studios try to recapitalize on the way a trailer looked.
Well, I think
you
a lot see of it too. I don't think they're ripping off trailers. There are studies that have been shown about like what color on color looks best to the human eye, which is why there are so many posters that use orange and blue because that is proven to be one of the most like fusionable two colors together. So I think a lot of times it's less. I really don't think that they looked at the Shape of Water trailer and went like, hey, let's. I think it was more of like, oh, like these two colors look good against
each
other.
It's not only just the colors, it's the font, though. Like
it's
the font.
All right.
There's water bubbles. Yeah. I mean, but in general, though, Rosamund Pike, like we were talking about off air earlier, ever since Gone Girl.
It's not Rosamund, is it? It's Rosamund. Rosamund?
Oh, my God.
I swear to God, I'm not doing a bit. It's Rosamund Pike.
I call her Rosamund Pike. Is that wrong?
I would have said, if I had to put money down, I would have said Rosamund Pike.
There you go.
I mean, who's to say? Who's to say?
Am I betting a thousand on this show?
No.
Rosamund Pike. Obviously, her performance was incredible in Gone Girl, so I'm all in on anything she does.
So good.
There are, like, you know, this is actually a biopic that I find that I want to learn from. Like Hidden Figures was a film that I learned a lot about a story. I don't know a ton about this story, so that's why I'm kind of interested in seeing it from that perspective. And I saw Theory of Everything was mentioned in the Jenny Slate in the trailer, and it basically said, like, you know, from the producers of Theory of Everything, right? And like that was actually a solid biopic. I thought they did a really good job with that. I mean, there are times where like these biopics check off certain boxes, but I don't know this story that well, and I'm actually interested in seeing it. I just think her performance looks incredible, so I'm all in.
All right, this is going to somewhat feed into the next conversation that we're about to have, but I'm going to make a confession that I don't hate all these movies coming to streaming. It's kind of nice on a Saturday night to hop over to Hulu and watch Palm Springs, or to just have The Old Guard waiting on Netflix. Like, I know that we're a champion of movie theaters, and believe me, when movie theaters open back up, I'm there. But I'm getting a little bit between Hamilton going to Disney Plus and Palm Springs coming to Hulu, and I'm starting to get a little bit conditioned to, hey, it's not so bad having these new movies waiting for me on my TV.
It's best case scenario of a worst case scenario.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. I don't want it to become the norm, but I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. The convenience of it is a little bit nice. So yep. Let's get to the next topic of conversation, which sort of goes along with that, and that's when movie theaters are going to open. So we have nothing concrete to talk about this week in terms of anything else being delayed. But a box office analyst early on Monday, which is when we are recording this episode, came out with a statement saying it's unlikely that Tenet is going to be able to keep its August release date, and had no real basis for how to back that up, or just basically with the way that numbers are trending and how a lot of states are going in the wrong direction. And especially here in the US where we all are and where we're recording our thing. And mind you, in no way, shape or form are the four of us trying to tell you that we are medical professionals or have any insight into what theaters should or should not do. But we kind of landed on a conversation in our text thread about movies potentially opening around the world and not here in the US, and whether they would do well. So we wanted to bring up the topic of, should movies begin to open without the US market and start to capitalize on some box office? And we lean into Tenet because Nolan is one of those directors who on a global scale is going to do better internationally, I think, than they would in the States. He has a global following, and I think that Warner Brothers would probably be looking to their international market to boost that. I think Mulan is another film that's very similar to that. In the text chain, Kevin was rattling off how Wonder Woman and Black Widow would also probably do really well overseas, and if the situations are better overseas, should they open? Should those movie theaters be able to open and maybe carry new product when the US are not able to? But then, Jake, you brought up a really good point of saying that already China has had to close a couple of times after reopening. And then right after that, you opened a story or shared a story about Hong Kong having to close its theaters after a third wave of coronavirus. So where are we at? Do you guys think that it's feasible or advised even that the studios, Hollywood studios, in an effort to save our industry, because it's looking that dire, I'm not really exaggerating, in an effort to save our industry and just get movies back into the marketplace, how do you guys feel about some films opening globally without opening here?
I think it would be incredibly arrogant to try to say that like the rest of the world should wait on America to open up movies. Mm-hmm. I think that is the equivalent of that person in your workplace that didn't watch this week's episode of Game of Thrones and like 4 days later is telling everyone, oh, you can't talk about it because I haven't watched it yet.
It's a good analogy.
I mean, if other countries, you know, especially if a large portion of the world has been following the rules, has been wearing masks, has been doing what they need to do to combat COVID-19, and they are seeing the positive repercussions of that, and that they are moving in a generally positive direction, and they feel that they can safely open movie theaters. Mm-hmm. Who are we as a country to say, no, you all have to wait for us because we haven't really been following the rules and we haven't been listening to the top medical experts, and because of that, we can't open our movie theaters. Therefore, you can't open yours either. And so I feel like it's incredibly arrogant to try to stop people from doing that. And also, like, it's going to help save an industry that we all love. Like, I'm sorry, like if someone in another country is going to get to see Tenet before I am, but if that ensures that people have jobs, if that ensures that it helps out people both working in movie theaters and at multifaceted levels of an industry that I deeply care about, then I'm sorry, I might end up getting Tenet ruined for me, but that's a sacrifice that I think anyone should be willing to make.
All right, so to throw it back at you just slightly, America, whether rightly or wrongly, claims to be the leader in film production because of Hollywood, right? And the Hollywood product that most people are, there are other, there are regional film industries. China has its own film industry. Italy obviously has its own film industry. There's other places that produce other titles. But cinemas around the world rely on Hollywood and the movies that are produced for them to entertain them on a grand scale. So those countries can still open and produce their own and start to show their own movies if they want to. I think it would be such a huge boost for them if they were able to have those new movies that opened. Kev, where are you at with this?
Well, for me personally, I think, as I mentioned earlier in the text thread, it's about survival of the movie industry, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about what this would do, so the question being, okay, so Tenet can't open, if it can't open in the U.S. in August because of our current state, and with if cases are spiking again, if movie theaters are closed, but there are other countries around the world that are in a better spot than we are that can operate, that can open theaters, that can give jobs, as Jake was saying. As somebody who wants to see Tenet so badly, I would rather the industry survive with the idea of movies opening internationally and just wait for it on my own. It happens all the time. Films open here all the time, then open up internationally later on. And there's that spoiler idea, then you worry about piracy. Piracy is a big question here as well.
Huge.
You open up Tenet or Mulan or No Time to Die internationally, and then you don't do it in the U.S., people are going to find a way to get it. And then that's going to be a problem in itself. Now, piracy is going to happen regardless of what we say and what we do.
Sure.
But it would be a very big deal for Americans not to have Tenet and the rest of the world has it and they know what the movie's about. And then we're here. I mean, there's no way it's not going to get back to us somehow. But on a money scale, I find these numbers very interesting. So let's look at two major releases, Tenet and No Time to Die.
Hmm.
Okay, No Time to Die first. Skyfall was a movie that made $1.1 billion at the box office. $804 million of that was international. $304 was domestic.
Wow.
So if you are the studio and you could make close to $1 billion internationally without the U.S. distribution, and that will help to ensure that the movie industry remains open, that the that theaters remain open, I don't see that being a problem. And then one of the other things I discussed earlier in the thread was Avengers Endgame. Avengers Endgame made $1.9 billion of its $2.7 billion internationally.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really big chunk of change. And I've said this on the show multiple times. International box office has become more important than domestic. It just has. They are making films to appease the global audiences. Fast and Furious is a global brand. Mm-hmm. That movie would still crush without the United States, probably more so internationally than it would here. So
I honestly think if Mulan could open in China tomorrow, Disney would open it.
Right. Yeah. And so the question is, should this happen? Our country is obviously in a very bad spot right now. And I do not think other countries should have to, again, like Jake was saying, suffer our consequences in regards to if we can't open up, but they can, why can't they move on with their lives? You know, and maybe it would be a wake up call for everybody in our country. And, you know, you open up, hey, you know what? We're going to give other countries these movies, but you guys can't have them because we're not following the guidelines as a general country.
Sure.
So I find that to be maybe a bit of a wake up call. You know, if a massive film can't open up here, and again, this is movies. There's a lot more wake-up calls that could happen in real life and things like that. But there are
things
that
we're not listening to those wake-up calls. We're not listening to hospitalizations and trending numbers.
But people love movies. So if you take movies away from them, it's almost like a kid, right? We're going to take this away from you until you actually act accordingly.
It's you've been grounded.
You're being grounded.
And you're sitting at your window watching the rest of your friends play outside.
Here's the thing.
While you're staying inside.
We're sitting here right now and we do not know and probably think that movie theaters are not going to open this year and or new movies are going to go in theaters this year. They're probably going to be pushed to 2021. That's where we're thinking at the moment. And the waves and the spikes and the cases are increasing in the country. I've been seeing ads all over different parts of the world for Tenet, like on staircases in like different parts of the world. That I think are places that the movie could open safely. I think I read today that New Zealand was virus free. I don't know if I read that correctly. So, you know, there are so many countries that these movie companies could still make a ton of money on. If Warner Brothers needs to make money, No Time to Die is a perfect international release.
Sure.
That is a British film. So in regards to, you know, where it comes from initially, but I do think that this is a conversation that needs to be had. If we, and I say survival, because if this is the only way to keep the industry afloat while our country gets our act together in regards to this virus, I think I'm okay with it.
Well, I'll say this too. I guarantee this is a conversation that's taking place right now at the studio level, and not to break it down in a cold-hearted way, but I'm sure they're measuring numbers and I'm sure they're measuring markets. And if they got to a point where enough markets were safe enough to open up in, I bet you they would pull the trigger and do it. But I want to bring up a personal story, because Michelle and I went to church on Sunday for the first time since the pandemic happened. And the two of us went without the boys because we wanted to sort of scope out and see how they were doing it, right? Like, I was just really curious about the process. I was so impressed by the organization of the church to get people into it. They had people standing at the doors giving you hand sanitizer as you walked in. They had an usher who met you and brought you to a seat so that you maintained social distancing. They had their pews were alternate so that you couldn't use one, but you could use the other. When you sat in it, you were socially distanced from anybody else in the seats. But communion, we're Catholic, and communion, the process was fascinating to me. The priest wore a full-on PPE mask, like a visor, yeah, and a mask. They handed communion out to families who were in a group, and in between each thing, they washed their hands in holy water, then and dried off with a tissue, then used hand sanitizer, and then handed out to the next person. If you went as an individual and not as a family, they washed their hands and did the sanitation in between each person. The process to give out communion took far longer than it should have ever done, but they did this to maintain the precautions.
That's so interesting.
And watching it, I was like, these are all lessons that a movie theater can put into practice.
There's a key difference, though.
Is it concessions? You're talking
about one church.
Yeah.
Versus a theater that has 20 screens,
right,
and then 4,000 of those across the country would all have to be exactly, like, literally micro, exactly what you're saying. But and I think that's the issue, though, is like you're going to church with families, and it feels safe because it sounds like everybody in your church was playing was going along with the safety precautions, right?
Sure, yes, of course.
I don't know that we can trust everybody else in the world to not do that, you know?
No, I totally understand. And because one other thing that bothers me about people having conversations about movie theaters and saying, like, they weren't the cleanest places in the world to begin with, and the way that people behaved by leaving a lot of trash or sitting up close to everybody, by going back to church was a different place. And I kind of think that when we go back to movie theaters are going to be a different place. And 100%. they're gonna be a system where you... because you want to be back there, you're going to almost follow the rules. Now, you're right. You can't put that much faith into the amount of people and the way that they're going to behave. But the church obviously went through a lot of effort to bring in volunteers and have people giving out hand sanitizer. If the theaters need to hire additional people to come and watch that multiplex to make sure that rules are being enforced, or else they're not going to be able to open business. Like, doesn't that seem like... Yeah. Maybe you're gonna have to do that.
All right, let's look at it from like it creates jobs.
It would create a job.
Yeah, if we lay it out like this, that's a great point. All right, let's look at a 25 screen theater, AMC Empire 25 in New York. Okay. So theoretically, AMC opens up. They hire 25 people to guard and watch each door.
Perhaps. Right?
Yes. Now, okay. So the other day I went to Six Flags. I did some segments from Six Flags. And when I went to Six Flags, every segment that morning was about the different checks that they were doing leading into Six Flags. So as I entered the park, I was temperature checked. I was 97.5, whatever it was. Then as I entered the park again, they put a fake weapon in my pocket so we could show people that you could go through security touchless. So they put like a fake gun in my pocket. I walk through. They show me on a screen where the image is. They have me remove the image and then put it to the side. No one touches me. No one pats me down.
Oh, wow.
Then as I entered the park, I had to keep a face mask on the entire time. Mm-hmm. 90 degree heat, right? So you're walking through the park. Certain elements of the water park were operating. Certain elements of the park were not. And then as you could remove your mask if you wanted to and eat and drink and then put your mask back on, mm-hmm. which still is kind of dicey to do in a theater because you're in an enclosed environment. So then
they're not
going to
forego that, though, because that's where they make their money.
Concessions. Yeah. Right. So people who know how movie theaters operate, they don't make their money on ticket sales. It's all that's why popcorn costs them, what, 25 cents to make it. They sell it to you for, I don't know, $12, whatever it is. So at the end of the day, it's an interesting thing. And I told you guys this. I was on that train all the way up through basically the end of June that I was like, I'm pumped to get back in. Then I went to Ocean City, saw the boardwalk, and I was like, I just can't trust people to do that. So I guess the end all be all thing here would be is if you have 25 in. So with theaters temperature check, they could, because the way Six Flags worked was I just walked through a thing. And there was, and the guy just looked at my temperature and that was it. So maybe families go in at a time. And if your temperature check, now temperature only gives you that one element. You could still have coronavirus without a fever.
Sure.
So I don't know. I can't foresee a logical way that 4,000 screens will be able to operate with that certainty. Like with a church, you have a certainty because it's kind of controlled. It's one place, right? So everyone's kind of like parking. They're going in.
But to that idea, isn't a theater just a collection of that one? Like it's 25 one places.
Right. 25
one
places.
So if you treat each individual theater with the care and precision that Sean's church was treated, if you came, and to Sean's point, if this is your only option, if it's feast or famine, if it's like either we bust our ass to make sure people are safe or we don't open our doors.
Right.
To me, that's an easy choice. Like, Sean, is it inconvenient? Sure. But we don't have a lot of options these days.
And because it was all still reduced capacity, which made it manageable, you know, and each of these theaters, each of these houses would be reduced capacity. You know, you're going to get a handful of people or the majority of people who still would say, God, no, I'm not going back. But you'd get the people who do want to be in the theater and they'd be under safe situations, you would assume. However, now that we're at this point, there's breaking news even regarding this. As we're having this conversation, literally this story just broke as we were doing it. Jakey, what'd you find?
I do have a quick question, though, before you go. Okay, I know the story you're going into, because this is something I find interesting. Tenant Oak, August 12th is the date, right? So we have the worldwide, and then we have the domestic. What would your personal feelings be as an industry, Sean, if they went the route of the international release and made us wait for Tenant till next year?
If it meant pumping some money into the film industry as a whole, I would support it. I would support it.
I think I would too. I mean, I would feel like if it saves the overall industry.
Yeah. What is the breaking news regarding this?
The breaking news that actually was discovered by Gabe, the governor of California has issued a statewide closure order of indoor movie theaters and restaurants, which is pretty massive.
That's almost them going back to phase
effective,
one.
Yeah, effective immediately. And we're not talking like a city, because if I recall, Atlanta just rolled back to phase one.
This is statewide.
We're talking about the state of California. I don't want to sit here and read the whole article for you, but it just broke while we were while we were talking about that, which is, right. I mean, that's a big deal.
Let's speculate about fun future movies instead of the movies that we will never get to see anytime soon. Kill Bill Volume 3, for some reason, is all over the news as of late, with fan speculation and casting of who might potentially play the daughter of Vivica A. Fox, who, spoiler alert, got killed in Kill Bill Volume 1. And the bride saw her daughter. Does the daughter have a name? Kevin, does the daughter have a name?
You're talking about the daughter in Kill Bill?
Vivica Fox's daughter.
Ooh.
Did she have a daughter? Did she have a name?
I don't remember.
She definitely had a name. I just can't remember what it was.
She had a name.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was. So they want to potentially have Zendaya's name was floated as someone who is the right age to play 17 years after
the battle. The idea being that the young girl would come back because the bride basically leaves the room after killing Vivica A. Fox and says, hey, like, when you get old enough, yeah, if you still have an issue with this, you come find me.
And yes, what's the line? Would. If you still feel sour about this, what's the line she says? Like, it's a pretty
specific. It's a really great idea that's not going to happen.
Why? Okay, why are you saying that it won't happen? I mean, it feels like something fun to do. Like, he left that as a tease.
I don't think that he's going to have that be his last movie. Especially because, I mean, it'd be one thing if he genuinely saw Kill Bill as two movies. And the idea could be that this could be the third and wrap up a Kill Bill trilogy.
Right.
But the thing is, he sees Kill Bill as one movie, rightfully so. And this just feels sort of like a tacked on thing that doesn't really have anything to do with what Kill Bill was about. Okay. And because of that, it doesn't feel like, I think he's putting a lot of stock and a lot of thought into what his last 10th film is going to be. And to me, Kill Bill Volume 3 falls in line with Vega Brothers, where it's just sort of like, yeah, it's a fun idea to imagine what would happen, but it ain't ever going to happen.
Let me ask this. What if a filmmaker that he really admires wants to take the idea and do it? And Quentin gives him his blessing.
Has he?
No.
I don't think he would ever do that.
Why not?
I think the days of him giving his characters to someone else are gone. When's the last time he did that? Was it from Dusk Till Dawn? If he wrote it, that's
what if he wrote it and just let someone and pick someone else to direct
it? I think the
it.
Problem is, I think he, see, it's different. I think, because obviously he did that with From Dusk Till Dawn. I think The Bride is too much of his baby. God.
What if he wrote it and Rodriguez directed it?
Well, I went to Rodriguez automatically too.
Kevin,
but
like, what do you think? So honestly, I think The Bride is too much of his baby. I think he loves that character too much. More so than he ever did, like the Gecko Brothers. I don't think he would hand off the bride to somebody else.
I don't think he does. I don't think he'll do Kill Bill Volume 3 with this either. And I'll tell you why. Quentin Tarantino.
Is this the most Kevin and I have ever agreed in an episode? I feel like we are on the same path today.
I don't like it.
But
I'm not crazy about it.
But Tarantino is the king of not fleshing things out. Like, you know, we've never fleshed out the briefcase. We've never fleshed out the diamonds at the end of Reservoir Dogs. You know, I think that he loves that idea of a mystery and like what could be. And I feel like if he directed a completion of a revenge story between those two characters, I think it would cheapen the drama that happened in the first one.
That little girl had nothing to do with Kill Bill. She had nothing to do with it.
It's too much time. I also feel like that little girl probably knew her mom was into some crazy stuff. I always kind of envision that scene. By the way, I think one of the most insane things about that sequence is the overhead shot of the kitchen as they're walking in. Remember when she throws the knife into the cereal box?
I just picture cereal. For some reason, when I think of that scene, I picture cereal flying.
It's such a great scene.
The daughter's name is Nikki, by the way. I don't know if that helps.
And so I just don't see Tarantino fleshing that out. I feel like that's a fan idea. I think that's a fan thing. And like Quentin Tarantino, I feel like he was going to want to end on something very unique. I don't think it's so funny. If you look at Quentin Tarantino's career, which film do you think he's most proud of?
Pulp Fiction.
I think he's most proud of Hollywood.
Really?
Okay. I really do. I think Hollywood is the movie. It's so different from anything he's ever done. I mean, obviously Pulp Fiction, I find to be a better film. I think Hollywood is the film that you make when you are able to do whatever the heck you want and fall in love with cinema again. I don't think Kill Bill is enough of a film in his mind that he has to continue it. Meaning that it's a big movie for him, but he finished it. We had the bride, Kill Bill, and Kill Bill was killed. it's literally done.
Dude, spoilers.
I know. But I mean, by the way, can I say Quentin Tarantino has two incredibly criminally underrated monologues in his movies that people don't talk about enough because everyone brings up Bastards and True Romance. The monologue that David Carradine gives to
Superman monologue
at the end about Superman is masterful. I also watched the other day the extended cut of Hateful Eight on Netflix. I think Sam Jackson's monologue to Bruce Dern is one of the best monologues that he's written.
Do you think he's telling the truth?
Lauren and I had the exact, so people who wonder what we're talking about, there's a moment in Hateful Eight, if people haven't seen it, where Sam Jackson's character basically looks at Bruce Dern and tells this horrific story about how he killed Bruce Dern's son in the film. In a very graphic,
it's a graphic story, man.
Cold way.
Hilariously graphic.
Yeah, and very over the top. Very, it almost felt like Jules was delivering his Ezekiel 25:17 speech again, the way he just like said the dialogue.
Yeah.
I find that monologue to be so criminally underrated. So I guess I was a tangent, but going back to Kill Bill.
Wait, do you think he was telling the truth in that monologue?
Oh, do I think he's telling the truth? I think he's telling the truth. 100%. Lauren thinks that he's just telling a story.
See, I think he's telling a story because of the Lincoln letter. But with the whole thing with the Lincoln letter, he tells Kurt Russell later that because of this lie he made up about carrying a letter from Abraham Lincoln, he was able to affect how white people act around him. So he is a master manipulator of knowing what to say to people around him to get them to do what he wants them to do. Because he needed Bruce Dern to give him a reason to like go after him, right?
And the only reason I would go against that is because the Lincoln letter was a continued story he told a bunch of people. I think it just shows
that he has the capacity and the mindset to do something like that.
I want to throw a wrinkle into the possible Kill Bill-ness of all this and whether Tarantino would let somebody else do it.
Okay.
I want to go back to earlier this year and I'm not trying to put this on their level, but I'm saying as a comparison that Bilal and Adil, when they brought Bad Boys back, right? Those are two guys. Listen, hear me out.
No. I'm actually listening.
There are two guys who worshiped at the altar of Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson and came to the table and said, we're going to make a new Bruckheimer Simpson movie. And they were given the opportunity to work with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. Now, was it as good? No, but it was close. Yeah, it was close, right? Now, you talk about Quentin and the number of people coming up, filmmakers coming up, younger filmmakers who have worshipped at his feet, at the altar of Quentin Tarantino, and are inspired by Quentin Tarantino. And if he finds a guy, if Tarantino were to find a guy, a young guy, shut your mouth. Is he that unique? Who could do something that is in the flavor of Quentin Tarantino?
He loves his creations. His creations are his babies.
And you're not trying to tell me there's someone else out there like Kevin and you who aren't obsessed with Tarantino.
No, what I'm saying is like you're comparing it to like I don't think Michael Bay and Bruckheimer care about the Bad Boys characters
as much as Tarantino cares
about The Bride.
But Bilal and Adil did.
Doesn't matter.
Let me go back. There's one thing you guys said that was very important early in the conversation. The only reason I would ever allow this.
It shouldn't happen. Stay on my side, Kevin.
No. Quentin, I'm on your side.
Kevin. Kevin, should I allow this? Kevin's like, no. I don't know. I have two things.
Let me ask the boys.
I genuinely think that he should not direct another Kill Bill film.
Okay.
Now, if Quentin Tarantino actually wrote.
Yes.
A Kill Bill Volume 3 script.
Has he not talked about at least doing some... Didn't he play with it?
He talks about Vega Brothers. Discussion. He talked about Star Trek. Sure. He talks about shit all the time. It's not going to happen.
But if he wrote a script, like, you know, you look at film... So I think that two of his best films were films he didn't direct, weirdly enough. True Romance and From Dusk Till Dawn. You know, From Dusk Till Dawn is one of my favorite movies ever. And Rodriguez directed it and Quentin wrote it. So I think what's interesting is I would not be against if they wanted it again. I would actually rather someone else direct his script than him direct it for his 10th movie. So, for example, if he wrote Kill Bill Volume 3 and it was like a masterful script and he just didn't want to end on that film and he did find a filmmaker to give it to and it was Quentin's characters and writing and someone else took it on to put it out. I would be okay with that. I don't know if I would like jump up and down screaming like, oh, I don't personally need any more Kill Bill. I'm good on my story. I'm good on my closure. But because of that news and because of that scene in Kill Bill, that's been a question for a long time about her coming back for revenge. Well, so if it needs to happen, have someone else direct it.
We are definitely over the course of our time on this planet, which might be short lived, mind you. We're going to get a point where Quentin Tarantino writes a script that someone else directs. Like in the future, I'm saying that will happen again because he might not want to direct anymore, but he's not going to stop writing. Yeah.
I have a question I would propose.
And he's so young.
If Quentin Tarantino makes, whether you want to call it Kill Bill Volume 3 or like Kill the Bride, and this is specifically for Kevin.
Kill Kiddo. Somebody said it should be called Kill Kiddo.
That's great.
Yes, it is.
Is it now a trilogy?
No.
Or is it just two movies?
Just two movies.
It's a trilogy.
Second film. No, it's not a
Kill Bill Volume 3 is the second movie.
That's one of the main reasons I don't want it to happen, because I don't want to get into this shit again.
I wanted to add, because he said, I've heard him talk about what's next. Yeah, he's talked about that forever, but he specifically has said that he's not done writing stories. He's just is done doing movies, and he wants to write plays, and he wants to write books.
So I think he probably is
interested in this. And if he is, we're either going to get a Broadway play of it, or we're going to get a book.
Well, he told us, and I know this because I re-listened to both of them this weekend. He told us that if Vega Brothers, Double V Vega, ever comes to fruition, it will be so as a graphic novel.
Wow. Yeah, I do think that Quentin Tarantino has already figured out what the story would be for this. I mean, he's so intricate in his details. I just feel like after watching all of his films for all of my life, and actually sitting down with him, as lucky as we have been to do that for interviews, I just find his passions to be somewhere else now. I don't find him in Kill Bill mindset anymore. I mean, like, news stories can come up that bring the material up, but I think Tarantino's head is somewhere else. I think he just became a father. And that fatherhood aspect of it could be an interesting sell in rewriting that and continuing Volume 3 from a parent perspective. There's a lot to be playing with.
Never
here.
Say never, I say.
Kiddo is a great title.
Yes, it is.
It's not going to be his 10th and final film. I don't think he's going to do that. I honestly wish he kind of ended on Hollywood.
Hollywood would have been the perfect 10th movie for him.
What if Sean gets a call from Quentin Tarantino? He's like, Sean, I want to say you were right. Kill Bill is two movies. That makes Hollywood my 10th film. Boom! And then he hangs up.
He's like Kramer and slams the money down on the table.
Kill Bill is two movies, so Hollywood was number 10. I'm good.
I hate that he's painted himself into this 10 film corner. And I know we've had this conversation multiple times, but I wish that he would just keep going. I mean, we've seen the likes of Scorsese and Spielberg and all these other directors.
I wonder sometimes if he regrets painting himself, because like we've said with the fact that like he says a lot of things, you know, because the wheels are always turning, right? Sure. And he is someone that always has a microphone in front of him. So whatever he says is going to be quoted and going to be picked up, and it's going to be spread like wildfire.
But
obviously he has said a lot of like, oh, I think I'm going to do this movie. And it turns into fact, you know, oh, I'm going to do Star Trek, or I'm going to do Double V Vega, or I'm going to do Kill Bill Volume 3. Do you ever think that like sometimes he just said the 10 movie thing and it just blew up so big that he felt the need to sort of stick with it and now can't go back?
But he could also just go in an interview and go, I'm going to keep going. And nobody would be mad about it. And that's the thing. It's like, I feel like we live in a society now where people say things and it's like concrete, or has to be concrete, or you can't. Like, I was saying this at the beginning of the show about how for the longest time, you know, I feel like I've gotten more mature, obviously, as I've gotten older. I'm 36 now. But, you know, there was a long period of time where I just wouldn't admit that I was wrong about something. I revisited Citizen Kane this weekend. And I did not love that film when I saw it at 20 years old, you know, and then I stayed in that mindset for a long time. I don't like Citizen Kane. I don't like the dialogue. Visually, it's incredible. And then I watched it yesterday. I'm 36. It blew my mind. Mm-hmm. Completely different perspective. And that's why another reason why I want to revisit Last Jedi. Gabe and I were discussing that today. So I guess the point I'm making is like, you know, Tarantino could so easily just go, you know what? I'm going to go to 11, Spinal Tap style, mother effers, and literally, you know, keep going. I mean, seriously, there's like so, he doesn't have to stick with it. And we run with it. He said it. It's a story, but he doesn't have to stick to it. That's not literally a law.
Like he said with the Star Trek movie, he's like, I might make a Star Trek movie, and then I will just say, that doesn't count. That one doesn't count towards the 10.
Yeah, but the whole reason that, you know, and I know we have to move on, but the whole reason that he's saying that he wants to stop at 10 is it so there's not diminishing returns, so that he doesn't keep making movies and then kind of have them start dipping. Idea that you can pick one movie from his filmography and it's just as good as the rest. They're at least within a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I ask you guys as fans, would you rather him stop and have all of his movies be incredible, or have him keep going and sort of have a guy that like was really good for a long time and then kind of really wasn't so great for a while?
So look at someone like Francis Ford Coppola. All right. Mm. You knock it out the park with Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Conversation, Apocalypse Now, Rumblefish. You're nailing it for, I don't know, two decades, a decade and a half, whatever
Jack.
It was. Yeah. I like Jack, actually. I saw that with my grandmother in New York and Long Island.
It's a strange film.
I like Jack. But it just has a special place in my heart. But anyways, but like, you're right. It's an interesting thing because like, I think you point to Hitchcock, right? And you look at Hitchcock and you like, I'll tell you right now, going back to Citizen Kane for a second. The fact that Orson Welles wrote, directed, and starred in that film, and he was 25 years old. He was 25. And I'm sitting on the couch yesterday as a 36-year-old grown man going, what am I doing with my life?
Like, no. Literally. Life expectancy back then was like 50. So
he 25
was, halfway to...
No, he lived till he was 70.
I'm only kidding.
No, but I mean, but I guess it's interesting because I guess, okay, this is actually a really good question. What filmmakers do you think got better later in life? So, okay, so look at Spielberg. All right, so Spielberg's knocking it out the park from the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s. I love Ready Player One, but I think we can all agree that there was a lull of time where he wasn't making films that we all thought were Spielberg quality. You know, I don't mind War Horse. I don't mind. I like Tintin. But I mean, Minority Report in Munich and then jump to Ready Player One. There was a long period of time there where there wasn't. So I guess Spielberg is a great example of this. Because
I think there are certain people who have very passionate stories that they tell when they get started. And they're the movies that they want to make. But then I don't think it's fair to say that a filmmaker should know exactly how to make a movie right out of the gate. And you almost have to make two or three before you even understand how it works, right? Like, to me, that's part of the reason why Damien blows me away, is because how the hell did he get to be so good of a filmmaker? And he's an extremely talented filmmaker. But, like, people might argue that George Miller, that Fury Road is his best movie.
All right. Yeah. Now, that's a great example. He directed his best movie at 69 years old.
But we're not talking, like a really good movie that someone did like later in their life, because you could argue that we're talking about a trajectory where like they're going like that. Because you could say like Scorsese turned in Wolf of Wall Street and like some incredible films later in life, but also in the 70s he was making Taxi Driver. So like
it's Mean Streets,
and Mean Streets. So like he's had a fairly even keel trajectory. He just continues. It's just astounding that he continues. I mean, but we're talking about, are there filmmakers that have done this? I mean, because you talk about like filmmakers needing to get stories out. And it breaks my heart to say this, I feel like Tim Burton has gotten out all the stories he wanted to tell, and that's now is just sort of turning out movies. Like, he's told all the stories he wanted to tell, and now is just stamping the Tim Burton style onto pre-existing stories.
Burton's exactly what Tarantino is trying not to become.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So, which I don't fault him for that.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's like, oh, let's reimagine Dumbo, but with Burton.
Alice in Wonderland, Dark Shadows.
Yeah. So it's actually a really interesting thing. I think Quentin Tarantino knows what he's doing in that regard, but it's so interesting because I would be really sad if I didn't have Ready Player One in my life. And if Spielberg stopped directing films after, you know, a certain period of time, you know?
This one might be easy, but I got a great one. James Mangold hit with Copland, which is a movie that he worked on for a long period of time, and it was his passion project. And he made Girl Interrupted and Kate Leopold and Identity, which are all good films.
I love Identity.
Yeah, they're good films, but I think he was also figuring out how to make films.
That's a great, great example.
Then he hit Walk the Line, 310 to Yuma, Night and Day, The Wolverine, Logan, and Ford v. Ferrari. That is an ascension.
All right. 10, how many is that? 9 films or whatever it is?
1, 2, 3,
it's,
4,
it, it's
5,
such an
6,
interesting
7,
thing.
8. 9, 10. Ford Ferrari B is 11.
So wow. I do understand Tarantino's perspective, because I think Tarantino's thinking about it from a legacy perspective, right?
Sure. Oh, 100%.
But I will say this. When I think of Alfred Hitchcock, I think of his classics. He might have made some poorly
but
made
I
films
can name
later.
Every film Tarantino's ever made. Can you name every film Hitchcock's ever made?
Yeah, but Hitchcock made like 50 films or something like that.
Maybe he shouldn't have.
I think that's the point.
Okay.
Maybe he shouldn't have.
I think Tarantino wants to be the kind of guy where you can name every single film he's done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll never forget interviewing him for Grindhouse and asking him if he regretted not directing True Romance. And, you know, he gave this great answer about Tony Scott. But like, I just always find it interesting that he gave that script to somebody else. But he did it. He did it From Dusk Till Dawn, but he had control over From Dusk Till Dawn. He was on set.
Sure.
I love the first half of From Dusk Till Dawn, which to me feels like Quentin Tarantino's movie. Mm. And then I think once the vampires come out, then it starts to feel like Robert Rodriguez's movie, and that's when I like it significantly less.
I always thought that I would love the genre shift in that film.
It just turns into a blur. Like I think I prefer the dialogue. I mean, granted, yeah, it's a great movie, but I think like the first half is a 10 out of 10. And then the B monster movie is like a fun 7 out of 10. But I think that is like you know, you be cool in the bar. John
Clooney,
Hawks.
Clooney is infinitely cool.
He's so cool. But that's John Hawks behind the bar.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I love John Hawks.
And also best tattoo ever in a film.
That's such a cool tattoo. Yeah. I think it's cool. I used to think it was so cool as a kid. When he has, we've talked about the reveal where he takes it off and you see it on his arm. But when he has the black jacket the on out. And you see just a little bit. Like on his neck. Oh, it's
Tarantino
coolest.
Seems to like tattoos that peek out a little bit.
Yeah. Kevin, get that one next. Can you get the Dusk Till Dawn one next up your entire arm and shoulder?
Gabe, if you don't mind me saying, I think we're missing out on a great blend game here. And I think it's such a great actor that doesn't get talked about enough. He's passed away now, but Michael Parks blend. Ooh. We got to touch on that.
Oh, God, I love Michael Parks.
Because he's so good in From Dusk Till Dawn.
We have to reach out to Kevin Smith and have Kevin Smith pick he as loves well because he's a massive Parks. Michael and that and Red State is a legitimate contender.
Red State was amazing, but
Tusk, he's great in Tusk.
Say
what you want to. I have mixed feelings about Tusk, but I think he is great.
He is good in Tusk.
We got to do Michael Parks blend because he's great From Dusk Till Dawn too.
That's a direction we should start going in with the blend games is like character actors.
Yeah.
Well, tell Gabe. He's wrapping us up and not even taking notes on what we should be doing.
Did you guys hear about Michael Parks' favorite show?
Parks and Rec?
Parks and Rec.
Yeah, sorry. That was bad. All right,
it's easy if I figure it out.
There is a black and white film coming to VOD on Friday called The Painted Bird. And from what we understand, it is a Holocaust film. Made some waves on the early film festival circuit. You guys will be able to check it out on paid VOD we didn't talk at all about, and I was raving about having these new movies available at our fingertips, and yet First Cow was available, and I didn't check it out yet. So that's still at the top of my list of something I need to see.
It's so funny, I'm going to sit down and watch First Cow.
Yeah.
But, like, aside from people raving about it, and people have not just raved about it, like, it was number one on a lot of people's top movies so far this year list. Yes. Like, number one.
Yeah.
Aside from that, there's nothing about that movie that makes me want to sit down and watch it.
I know.
And especially, like, everyone, like, from what I've seen about, like, it's a slow burn. You just have to sit down and watch it. Like, none of, like, what, like the plot description or, like, the images that I've seen. Aside from people telling me it's amazing.
Pictures of a cow.
It's a cow.
I know.
Say this, like, don't flip out because, like, I love anyone that's listening and loves this movie. I say it knowing I'm sure it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But there have been multiple moments where I've sat down and been like, is now the time? Well, and then I go, nah.
Is it a prequel to Chazelle's movie?
First Man, we've made that joke.
I'm not going to, to keep the first bit going, another movie that fell into that was First Reformed with Ethan Hawke.
I did love
great movie, Reformed. By the way.
It's really good, but it was one of those films that, like, I knew I needed to watch it, and the screener was sitting there forever.
It's right there.
Yes, and I was like, everyone says it's great. Yeah. Do I really want to watch Ethan Hawke as a struggling priest? So, anyway, The Painted
Bird.
Now,
if and the first Reformed plot were the plot for First Cow, now you're talking. Now you're talking about a movie I pressed play for, where it's like a cow like is like struggling with his faith.
Right. Whipping himself and wearing a hair shirt. We did see The Sunlit Night, as obviously from our earlier conversation with Rebecca. This is a really great vehicle for Jenny Slate. Another one of those actors that just doesn't get the amount of work that I feel she should. Like, she's a really great leading actress. She does really great character detail. This is a strange film for her in that she's a struggling 30-something who has no real direction in life. We've seen that done before. And I was settling in for this to be the, you know, a Brooklyn-esque 20-something, 30-something who's trying to figure out what to do with their life. But then instead she just picks up and heads over to Europe, where she takes on an assignment to paint a barn. And she's going to paint it with these various shades. And I was like, paint a barn? Like, are you really being... But it was an artistic project. And she's being brought on board because of her artistic ability.
And the barn is where the first cow lives, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I was trying to figure that out. Okay, cool.
That was the crossover.
Thank you.
Another great example of how talented Jenny Slate can be. Really rewarding to just see her continue to grow into really cool roles like this. I'm glad it's on VOD because it feels like one of those titles that just would have got completely buried at theaters if it got onto a screen at all. So make sure you check out The Sunlit Night when it hits VOD on Friday alongside The Painted Bird, and you can catch up with First Cow, a film that the Real Blend guys really, really want to see, but just haven't had...
But not badly enough to see it.
Yeah, well, let's race. First one to see First Cow gets to bring the review back here to the show, and we'll discuss it at length.
Yay.
Yeah. Instead, Jake's like, hey, you should watch Cloud Atlas and tell me when you're going to start it. And
hey,
we'll start at the same time.
Remember that time Gabe and I had a date to watch Cloud Atlas and he blew me off to finish Last of Us Part 2?
What happened with
that? I remember.
Is that what happened? Gabe, how is Hamilton?
I hear it's good.
I was all set. I had my glass of wine. I was like ready to like turn in like this 3-hour movie. And I was going to like text Gabe and all of a sudden I even like texted him like, hey, do you want to push it up to 7:30 since it's like a 3-hour movie? And all of a sudden I got like a, sorry, dude, I'm playing Last of Us Part 2.
Wait, well,
it's
okay.
Weird. It's
to
almost
fair,
as if.
Gabe, was that the night that you texted me at 9 and we watched Cloud Atlas together?
You asshole.
Hey, listen.
Is it because Gabe night. Discovered that there's a pause button on his PlayStation?
I didn't know.
In my defense, The Last of Us Part 2, the story is incredible.
Yeah. I've been told it's the Last Jedi of video games, so that makes me think I'm not going to like it.
All right. One thing I found out, though, of why we didn't watch that is that it ends like 7 times. I was like, oh, this is the end of the game, and then I still had another
it's
like,
the Return of the King
play.
Of video games.
It just kept going. It's great, but it just kept going.
Jake also
it's like,
likes
it's like
to
that
watch
bit
a movie
in
20... with people. Kevin, has he done this to you? Like, Jake likes to watch a movie with people. Like, whenever we mention that we haven't seen something, he'll be like, you want to watch it together? Like, we can start at the same time. Like, we did it. What was the episode?
I'm sorry, asshole, that, like, I care about you watching a movie and
I'm
I want to experience
that cool.
with you.
While we watched The Leftovers, Jake would repeatedly join me for certain episodes. And I'm saying it's cool.
I keep a list of people that I like to watch stuff with.
You're offended. You're taking this the wrong way.
Guess you just got marked off the list.
Put me
Look at all the people
that
are marked
cow.
Off the list.
When you're ready to watch First Cow, text me and we'll press play at the same time. This week's blend game. Hashtag Nicole Kidman blend, celebrating the legacy of the former Mrs. Tom Cruise, who has been incredible in so
the
many things.
Mrs. Keith Urban.
Current Mrs. Keith Urban.
Wait,
as well,
she's Nicole Kidman, amazing
Academy
actress.
Award
yes,
winner,
yes,
Keith Urban.
Yeah, yeah. She is Nicole.
She doesn't belong to anybody else.
She's probably on her way to an EGOT, I would assume, right?
Yeah. So she has the Emmy. She has the Oscar.
Yeah. Probably not a Tony. I'm not sure she's ever been on stage.
Would she have won a Grammy for the Moulin Rouge soundtrack?
Very possible. I'm going to look that up while you, Jakey, start telling us what your pick was for Nicole Kidman.
My pick for Nicole Kidman blend was a little bit easier than I thought, but it was also, I was kind of surprised that compared to what I'm assuming that you guys are going to pick, I chose The Others.
Oh,
and the
that's
reason
a really good
I
one.
Chose The Others is just because it's such an incredibly low key, subdued performance that is made all the better when you get to the ending, when you realize what this shocking revelation is, and then it's a performance that completely changes upon rewatch of that movie. I'm going to get into, I think, Gabe, I think it's a 20-year-old movie. I think it's safe to get into spoilers for The Others. The idea being, it's 20 years old. I'm sorry. This is a movie podcast.
You just have to give a warning. Just a warning.
It's a warning. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it.
There you go.
It's basically a mother with two children in a giant house during World War I, I believe. The children are allergic to light. Therefore, they have to keep the house very dark. She's very overly protective of her children. The twist being at the end that they discover that they're actually all dead, that she slipped into a depression after her husband was killed in the war, murdered her children, and then killed herself.
As one does.
which is just unbelievable. And so when you go back, and unfortunately, I feel bad because the others kind of came out in the shadow of The Sixth Sense.
Very much
so. Unfortunately, a lot of people sort of just wrote it off as like, oh, it's ripping off The Sixth Sense. But the way a lot of people describe the Bruce Willis performance, there are a lot of actions that Bruce Willis takes in The Sixth Sense that make you think differently. And those actions were written by M. Night Shyamalan. Hmm. I would argue Nicole Kidman's performance as a whole is what, not what is scripted in terms of like a doorknob that she, you know, or a check that she doesn't get to the table. It's her actual performance as a whole that changes in the rewatch, which I think is just as impressive, if not more so. So I think I would argue the fact that she turns in almost two performances in that movie, one for the first watch and one for the rewatch. It's absolutely astounding. It at first is uncomfortable and terrifying. Then it's heartbreaking when you realize the realization. It's awe-inspiring and really a testament to, as we've said, and we were joking at the beginning of this game, obviously she's not anyone's ex-wife or current wife. She's an incredible Oscar-winning actress. And I think she really shows her chops in that movie.
She's halfway to an EGOT. She has the Emmy and the Oscar. So no Grammy.
I would have thought maybe she would have gotten a Grammy for.
I would love to see her on stage. Some people, though, and again, I mean, no slight toward Nicole Kidman. It sounds like I'm slighting Nicole Kidman. I wonder if she's more comfortable on camera than she would be on a stage. You know, some people are just, they're more comfortable in the element of film.
Yeah.
Whereas other people don't mind being on stage in a live element. And since she's never, well, I don't know, has she tried theater? I'm not familiar with whether she has or not. So
I don't know.
Some people, you just, they're born movie stars. But and then there's other that cross over pretty easily. Kevin, your choice for Nicole Kidman blend is?
I went with Moulin Rouge. Ooh. I feel like it's obvious. Just because it's amazing.
Well, if Lauren's choosing,
Lauren would choose Moulin Rouge as well. I mean, I mean, that's basically like a mutual pick. It's Baz Luhrmann. It's incredible. It's just, I don't know. For me, that film, from a spectacle standpoint, matched its performances. Like, you know, there was never, the performances were never above the filmmaking, and the filmmaking was never above the performances. It was a beautiful blend of filmmaking, I found. And I just thought, I don't know, that's my favorite Nicole Kidman movie. That's all I really have to say about it.
That was my second choice.
Yeah,
so, Moulin Rouge was a great choice.
I saw it in theaters. It blew my mind. You know, I was going to go with Eyes Wide Shut only because I do like that film, and it's Kubrick's last film. But I think, or Destroyer was really good too. But I think Moulin Rouge, no question.
I thought about Eyes Wide Shut as well, but I sort of felt like that was more Cruise's movie than her. Like, I think of Cruise when I think of that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say this about Nicole Kidman as I'm about to give my choice. She doesn't make movies that I like enjoy, love, right? Like, Moulin Rouge might be her most accessible one because it's the most fun kind of one. Like, it's a musical. You can dial back into it. She makes really dramatic films with really tough performances that a lot of times you don't want to go back and revisit because it's such
Batman Forever.
Yeah, like Batman Forever for sure. No, like her entirety on Big Little Lies. Like her performance on Big Little Lies is absolutely incredible. And she's playing an abused spouse.
Yeah.
And all the ramifications that come with an abused spouse. Yeah, the hours, exactly. And my pick, which is Stoker. Stoker is, she's so incredibly good in it. It's Park Chan-wook.
I've never seen it.
Oh, dude.
I've never seen
it. The guy who directed Old Boy. Stoker was the one in the house, right? With the staircase. Like, I saw Stoker. Yeah.
What
is
this?
It's a modern Hitchcock film.
Oh.
Where Nicole Kidman is the mother. Her daughter is Mia Wasikowska.
Yep.
When her husband passes away at the beginning of the movie, the brother comes to visit. It's the uncle. And it's essentially, can they trust the uncle? What's going on with the daughter? There's a lot of weird things that are happening. And Nicole Kidman just cements the entire thing together with her unbelievably powerful performance.
Great movie.
I wanted to choose. Well, I chose that. I love her in that movie. And it's a really riveting film with a ton of huge surprises that I don't want to give away. But the other one I was going to pick was Rabbit Hole, which is where she plays a mother who had just recently lost a child and bonds with the son, played by Whiplash dude.
Miles Teller.
Yeah. The friend of the son, she forms a friendship with him, essentially. And it's just such an incredible story, but it's one I don't want to watch it again. I don't want to watch. She's so good in it, Rabbit Hole. And she's so good in Stoker, but it's not the type of movie where you're like, hey, let's pop down on the couch and watch Rabbit Hole, where this mother grieves about her child that she lost.
Is that, and maybe I'm confusing it with a different movie. Is that the movie where she has a child that was like a school shooter? Or am I confusing like two completely different movies?
I think you're thinking of Tilda Swinton.
Is that?
And we need to talk about Kevin.
We need to talk about Kevin? Maybe so. Yeah. Okay.
No offense to you, Kevin.
No, no, none taken. I like Stoker, though. It's a really good choice because I remember finding that film because of Old Boy. Like, mm-hmm. I just became a fan of his films. And that was one of the ones I watched.
Yeah. Visually mesmerizing.
Yeah.
And has some incredible, incredible transitions. So I chose Stoker. It's probably my favorite film of hers. I also do love Moulin Rouge. So many of her movies are so incredibly good. And, but again, she takes on these dramatic roles. So audience picks. Hayley McCoy chose Cold Mountain. Anna and several others went with Moulin Rouge. Brent and countless others mentioned Big Little Lies. Jenny Olerby said The Others. Okay, so The Others, Brendan says that he wants to watch a horror movie. But like with a 12-year-old, horror is defined in a very specific way.
Yeah.
So The Others and The Village are the two movies that I've singled out as like, dude, you're going to love these movies. And he won't watch them. He thinks they're too scary. He knows nothing about either of them. But every night, Michelle and I'll be like, Brent, The Village tonight? He's like, nope. And I'm like, but you want to watch a horror movie.
So what is the horror that he wants to watch? Like, what is acceptable to him?
He saw Gremlins and he saw The Monster Squad. And he's seen
so still kind of in that and still in like in the Amblin
kind of
world.
Yeah, the jokey sort of.
That's I mean, that's a bit of a jump from
I think you should rip the bandit off and just show him like Dr. Sleep or something. Just get, you know, get that over with and then go backwards. Yeah. Everything else won't seem as horrific.
Or just go straight to like Rob Zombie.
He's seen Jaws. Jaws was another transition. That was a bit of a transition, yeah. But he thinks he wants to be challenged by something else. And I think The Others is a safe enough. He's seen Sixth Sense. He watched Sixth Sense. So especially after Sixth Sense, I was like, dude, The Village.
I think The Others are scarier. I think I like The Sixth Sense better, but I think The Others are scarier than The Sixth Sense.
I think that's probably fair. I have to go. I have to watch The Others again. I haven't seen it in a while. Calhoun and Corey Chizola went with Rabbit Hole. Corey works at CinemaBlend with us. And then Christian and several others chose I'd Wide Shut. Great participation from everybody this week. Gabe, you son of a gun. For next week, you can reach out on Twitter using hashtag Paul Greengrass Blend. We'll be celebrating the films of the kinetic director, Paul Greengrass. You can play along on social media. You can tweet us at RealBlend, or you can email us, as many of people have been doing recently, at RealBlend@CinemaBlend.com, including Kyle David Perry. Kyle David Perry, a good friend of the show, another of the Chicago Blenders, who used the review system to get this most recent fan review to us. It says, finally giving the real credit you deserve, R-E-E-L. Well played, Kyle. Well played. As a longtime listener, it brings me great joy to finally be able to leave Real Blend an actual review. If you like in-depth conversations with the biggest names in the film entertainment industry, then Real Blend is for you. If you like passionate, sometimes hilarious arguments on everything from remake relevance to semantics, hashtag Kill Bill is one film, then Real Blend is for you. You want year-round awards Oscar talk? Real Blend's got it. The nerdiest discussion about frame rates and film grain? They got it. Honest reviews on the newest movies? Got it. Petty threats to quit their own podcast? Done. Inside jokes you will instantly be a part of on social media? Yep. Puns of varying quality? You know they got those. Hey, Kevin, did you hear about Gabe's favorite Rob Reiner film?
Oh. Hold on a second. Wait, is this good?
It's pretty good. Have you ever heard of Rob Reiner's? Oh, Gabe's favorite Rob Reiner film.
Wow. I'm immediately going to When Harry Met Sally. I just don't know where to go with that.
Right.
I don't know Rob Reiner's favorite.
It's called This is Spinal Rap.
That's really good. That's very good.
That's pretty good. More importantly.
No. Oh, rap.
Wait, whose favorite? Rap.
I get it now. Oh, this is Spinal
Rap.
It's
Gabe's favorite Rob Reiner.
Final. Okay, rap. Okay, that big. Okay, I got it.
Because explaining a joke always makes it funny.
But no, because I thought, because it's a homonym, I thought it was R-A-P, which is, I was like, what does Gabe have to do with rapping? You won't even listen to Hamilton.
Oh, rap, gotcha. More, I gotcha. Anyway, more importantly, if you want to join a community of amazing people that gather to listen to three fabulous hosts, then listen to Real Blend. Reach out to the Blenders on Twitter. We would love to talk with you. I actually met three of my best friends via this podcast, so I can honestly say Real Blend changes my life. Much love to Kevin, Jake, Sean, and Gabe. All four guys are genuinely lovely people in person. That's a hard one to do. Thank you for the amazing content and for showing me that other people think the way I do. It means the world. Sincerely, Dunkirk. What a great... Thank you very much,
Beautiful.
Kyle.
That's awesome.
For throwing that review out there for us. Yes, well played. So, we will be back next week with a brand new episode. You guys can follow us on social media, as you know, at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Real Blend. You can drop us a review on iTunes. You can email it to realblend@cinemablend.com. And you can shop on our merch store, cinemablend.com/shop. So thank you very much for tuning in to this week's episode. Gabe, I need you to turn on your microphone for 1 second. When do you think we will have the commentary track?
Oh, yeah, that should be next week.
Next week? Cool.
You can plug it.
Oh,
yeah,
good. We did a commentary with Tony Cervoni, where he walked us through Space Jam, and it was awesome. It was awesome. He came on and talked Scoob, which he directed, and he was the animation director for Space Jam, and he had so many really cool stories to tell. So go out of your way this week to find a copy of Space Jam and have it queued up for when we have that director's commentary, because we're going to play that next week. It'll be one of our bonus episodes. And yes,
I'll also tease hashtag if it happens.
Yes,
we have a very prominent actor that should be on the show next week that we're interviewing tomorrow.
We do. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, we do. So that, oh, yeah. So that'll be a lot of fun.
And I know who it is.
And I'm deep into their movie and I'm enjoying it. So that's cool. I hope it sustains. So
Sean, you didn't happen to rent that film, did you?
It was not a rental, Kev.
Oh.
It was a streaming link. It was a streaming link.
Okay, yes. Cool. But I was just wondering if you rented it.
Yeah.
God, this show is bad. It's really good. This show is really bad.
All right, bye, guys. Until next week.
Dunkirk.
Jesus Christ.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.